The Eternal Light. The National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations present The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Present the first of two conversations with outstanding public figures. Our guest is Theodore Bicall, folk singer, actor, and raconteur. Mr. Bicall is interviewed by NBC News correspondent Elmer Peterson through the facilities of station KNBC, Hollywood, California. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Bicall, most men consider their lives successful if they are able to succeed in only one career. You have gained worldwide recognition and fame as an actor, but merely being an actor doesn't seem to satisfy you.
Well, I don't think really a question of not being satisfied. It's just that being an actor seems so transitory. As soon as the theater seats are cold, the memory of what you've done fades in people's minds. And I think a man should be remembered.
Many stories have been told about the egocentricity of actors, how they take themselves too seriously and are self-centered. I'm sure you know the joke about the actor who meets a friend of his on the street and after an hour of talking about himself says, "But enough of all this talk about me. Let's talk about you. Have you seen my latest play?"
Well, I suppose lots of actors are egocentric. One shouldn't confuse the two things, however. You know, to take one's work seriously and to take oneself seriously doing the work are two different things. I hope I should never fall into the trap of doing the latter and always do the former. Because there's a Chinese proverb that says the man who laughs at himself has no trouble winning the affection of others, and I've always tried to live by that.
While many people associate you with Israel, you were not actually born there, were you?
No. I was born in Vienna, 1924.
When did you leave Vienna for Israel?
In 1938, and lived there for 8 years.
What sort of specifically Jewish education would a young boy have received in Vienna, a Central European city?
I don't know about the average boy, but I know that in my family, I received an intensely and intensively Jewish education. The Hebrew teacher came to the house before I went to any school altogether. And I spoke Hebrew with my father because he wanted me to, and I spoke Yiddish to my grandmother because that's what she understood best, and German to my mother. And with the exception of the last-named language, the other two are very intensely Jewish.
So you have a good background in Jewish education.
Yes, and a strong religious identification, too, that while perhaps I wouldn't be classified as an ultra-Orthodox Jew, I do go to the Orthodox synagogue because emotionally it means more to me than the other kinds.
Mr. Bicall, few people in any walk of life, let alone actors, have been as active as you for causes in which you believe. Now, I cite civil rights as but one example. Do you attribute this activism in any way to your religious training?
Absolutely and definitely. I have always maintained that if these things that you learn and study and that all people profess to believe and all religious people profess to believe the Bible, if you are to take them seriously, then you must apply them, interpret them in light of the events of today. And if you take civil rights, for example, I really don't know how you interpret a phrase that says in Hebrew, "V'ahavta le'reacha kamocha," thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. It says neighbor. It doesn't say white neighbor. It doesn't say Jewish neighbor. It says neighbor. How do you apply this except in civil rights? How do you say taking care of the stranger in your midst, who incidentally has to be taken care of more assiduously than your own because you have an entire social fabric to do it for you and he does not. How do you do that? Except in civil rights. I don't understand how people can maintain that they are religious on one hand and segregationists on the other. They are strange animals to me.
Another cause with which you have been long and actively associated is, of course, Israel.
It is not merely a sense of nationalism that drives me to an identification with Israel. Not merely a sense of personal history, because I have lived there for 8 years. But it goes beyond that. It is, after all these centuries of there being only a Jerusalem of the Spirit, there is now an actual Jerusalem, a geographical Jerusalem, and a rallying point, an identification point. And all this nonsense talk about dual loyalties is just so much water under the bridge. I never understood why the cop on my beat in the street in New York, Mike O'Hurley, he is never accused of dual loyalty because he happens to sing Irish songs and feels a great identification with Galway Bay and goes to Dublin and tears run around down his cheeks when he does. He's never accused of dual loyalty, but I, the Jew, am. And it's nonsense.
Have you been back to Israel recently?
Yes. Yes, I was there just a few weeks ago. And an extraordinary feeling, you know, to have, in the light of the events, the recent events, to have stood on the ramparts of the old city, or at least within shouting distance of the old city of Jerusalem, a place where one walked as a child, knowing, or at least believing, that one would never, ever be able to walk these streets again. And then to see on television that Jews walked through the streets, went to the Wailing Wall, and prayed there. An extraordinary feeling.
What do you think of the current Mideast crisis involving Israel?
Well, we could spend an entire hour on this particular subject, and suffice it to say that the claims of the Soviet Union notwithstanding, I find it difficult to reconcile numerical and geographic facts with their contention that it is Israel, with its less than 2 million inhabitants, surrounding 60 million Arabs. I don't know how 2 million people surround 60 million people. I don't know how geographically a country that is outnumbered in acreage, 300-1, surrounds, threatens the very survival, indeed aims at the survival of its neighbors. It was always Nasser and his cohorts. It was always the Arab states who maintained that Israel had to be pushed into the sea, obliterated from the face of the earth. Israel has never maintained that the Arab states should be dealt with thus. And so, you know, one feels an extraordinary sense of dichotomy, because I am a peaceful man and a pacifist, and I'm not very good at bearing arms of any kind at the same time. And again, in view of the accusation, Jews don't fight, Jews are yellow, Jews are coward, Jews never fight, they never know how, they go to their slaughter as lambs would. The lies given to many of these things in Israel today.
Have you ever gone back to the country of your birth, Austria?
Yes, I have. Not a very pleasant experience. I went back for several reasons. I had to take care of some family business, A and B. We were making, of all things, a Bible album for which a New York company had put their studios at our disposal, and the studios happened to be in Vienna. It was a strange and extraordinary experience. You see, Austria tries to pretend today that they are to be numbered among the victims of Nazi aggression instead of accomplices. So I walk the streets of Vienna, and I find that people maintain that they, like myself and my family, were victims of Hitler, when I know much better that they were the ones who overnight all of a sudden wore swastika armbands and were a little fiercer even than some of the Germans that one knew. So it's a strange feeling, and not a pleasant one.
Mr. Bickel, you have been acclaimed by critics time and again as one of the world's greatest character actors. In fact, when one looks over the variety of roles that you've played, one cannot help but be amazed. You portrayed in films and on the stage a Chinese crook, the dean of an American university, a Scottish police officer, a Russian submarine skipper, A Jewish refugee, a Greek peanut vendor, a psychopathic killer, a French tax evader, a Czech MVD officer, a Hungarian linguist, a Dutch patriot, a Southern sheriff, etc., etc., etc.
Well, I once was quoted as saying that acting to me is a global affair. I think I'll amend that. Living to me is a global affair, and since my life is so tied up with my work, the two go hand in hand. I do have a modicum of talent when it comes to languages. I can think myself into these frames of mind. I can also linguistically reproduce the sounds. Consequently, I get all these extraordinary variety of parts. And that is, I guess, the reason for this extraordinary recitation, which at times even impresses me, although it ought not to.
But wouldn't it be simpler to be a straight leading man instead of a character actor?
Oh, heavens no. Straight leading men are usually very dull. They are dull, and the parts they play are dull. You can never say that about character actors. Well, maybe about some character actors you might, but certainly not about character parts, because they're never dull. There's always a challenge in it. You have to assume somebody else's gait, his mode of speech, his walk, his age. All that is a challenge to an actor.
This brings up the question of which of your many roles did you like the best?
Depends on the stage, I would say. For 2 years, I did a play in London called The Love of Four Colonels, which perhaps is still one of my favorites in the live stage performances. And in movies, I know there's The Sheriff that you mentioned in The Defiant Ones, which was an extraordinary film to my mind. A prematurely liberal film, one may say, conceived by Stanley Kramer, about two prisoners who escape chained to one another, a white man and a colored man, hating each other's guts but being chained together. Rather symbolic, because we are chained together.
In that connection, didn't you receive an Academy Award nomination as the best supporting actor for your role as the sheriff in The Defiant Ones?
Yes, I did. Which is kind of amazing, because I'm really not a Southerner, but I felt that I had to be authentic and convincing, not merely in Los Angeles or in New York or in London, but in Atlanta and in Dallas.
Well, one thing is certain. Few actors, Mr. Bickell, have enjoyed such an enormous string of successes as have you. For 2 years, you were Mary Martin's leading man in The Sound of Music. Your role in the Broadway play, The Rope Dancers, was hailed by the New York Times as a rare gem of brilliant acting. Have you ever had any real failures?
Oh, yes, certainly. Except you don't hear about those as frequently as you hear about the successes. Fortunately, the public has less of a chance to be exposed to one's failures. Oh, naturally. In fact, even fairly recently. Ironically, they both had the word cafe in the title, which perhaps indicate something, although I don't really quite know what. One was called Cafe Crown and the other one was called Pousse Cafe, but I don't really think that word cafe is jinxed for me. One does learn from failures, and they do remind one that one is fallible and therefore human.
Mr. Bickell, critics have described you as an actor not only of polish but integrity. You seem to be very discriminating, shall we say, about the roles that you accept. And then, once you do accept a role, you give it your all.
Well, I figure that your choice in accepting whatever is offered to you or not is a question of taste. And taste is something that you don't really acquire. You certainly don't acquire it with money. And speaking of money, this is one instance in which I welcome the fact that I earn a great deal of money, because, to my mind, that serves only one purpose. I mean, you can only drive one car at a time. You can only eat three meals a day. Well, if you're a glutton, you could eat five, but there's only so much money you really can spend on yourself and on your family. But the one thing that money does give you is the freedom to say no to things you don't want to do. And that's where that sense of weighing one against the other comes in. I'm not saying that I'm always making the right decisions. One has failures in one's work. But, so, you know, you sometimes make a wrong value decision. You don't choose a hit, as it were. And nor do I set out to choose hits. I choose the things that tickle my palate, that are challenging and interesting to do.
And yet you don't seem to believe in art for art's sake. You have said that you use your singing and acting as weapons against bigotry and misunderstanding.
I don't know whether art for art's sake really is correctly used in the context of that question, because, you know, one says you art is art for money's sake or for the sake of making a living, and the other one is art for its own sake. Now, this is an extraneous matter, that you use your singing and acting as weapons. That is using your art. Because, after all, what is art? Art is not merely a reproduction of life. It is a reproduction of a slice of life with comment. The author wants to tell me, the audience, the reader, something. Similarly, the actor, with comment, wants to present to an audience, not just merely life. It would be totally uninteresting to just show a lady in curlers in her kitchen. But you also want to show the audience what that lady means, what her curlers mean, what her life means, what this extraordinary set of circumstances that she's pressed into in the short space of a play or a film means. So I say that one should use one's work, one should use one's art. And I'll never forget Pablo Casals, an extraordinary interview. He primarily said, my cello is my weapon, he said. And by that he meant he chooses where he wants to play and for whom.
Aside from your busy acting schedule, you always manage to set enough weeks aside each year for folk concerts. Your annual concert appearances take you to at least 40 cities in the United States, and you have also toured England, New Zealand, Australia, Israel, Holland, France, Spain, and other countries.
Well, yes, I am a man, as you mentioned, with a lot of hats, well, at least a few hats, and one of them is that of a folk singer or folk performer, and the medium of concerts is a very important one there. I find it very challenging, because, you see, there's hardly any scenery, there's only a modicum of lighting. You have to, in a figurative sense, paint your own scenery, set your own mood, paint your own stage, as it were, and you are thrown to your own devices. It's you and the song and the audience, nothing else.
You've mentioned that you speak several languages. Are there any occasions where you do run across a language barrier?
Oh, yes, quite frequently. I sing in 21 languages, but I don't speak all of them. I speak six rather well. I get by in a couple of others. Naturally, that at times languages are a problem. For example, I have been known to have played roles or sung songs in a language that I really don't speak, but since my accent is very good in most languages, people afterwards come up to me and insist that I reply to them in their language because they've heard me singing it, and I can't. Of course, I understand what I'm singing, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I can speak the language. In some of the countries, it might become a problem, but not too much.
I understand that you always include several Hebrew and Yiddish songs in your concerts in order to give emphasis to your cultural heritage.
Always do. I always do. Whatever the subtle difference may be, I'm not a folk singer. I'm a singer of folk songs. Except in Hebrew and Yiddish, when I am a folk singer, then I sing of my own. And it is important. I'm intensely curious about my neighbor, how he works, how he walks, how he talks, how he sings, how he dances. I'm also intensely conscious and aware of my own heritage, and I hope I make my neighbor curious about my way of singing.
Do you find that non-Jewish audiences respond to your Hebrew and Yiddish songs?
Oh, sure. I sang Hebrew and Yiddish for Maoris in New Zealand and for American Indians in Oklahoma. And I sang Hebrew and Yiddish for Queen Elizabeth at Buckingham Palace. And I found a very warm and receptive audience wherever I go. Incidentally, there are quite a number of nuns who buy my Hebrew and Jewish records. I get letters from them.
What do you think of the recent development of folk rock from folk music?
I listen to a lot of it. At best, it is a very important expression of our age. At worst, it's neither folk nor rock, of course. It's just noise. It's a folk-derived and folk-based idiom, and I welcome it because the text, the words, mean something, and incidentally mean quite a lot. If you listen to some of the Beatles songs, Eleanor Rigby, for example, a most important song, and a song that speaks of the anguish of the age and of the youth of our age better than anything else that I could cite to you. And so it goes with many of the songs. Of course, there too one has to make value judgment. Not all folk rock is good.
Then content is very important to you in folk music.
All important. All important. Because the format is usually fairly simple. But many people have forgotten or abandoned their own traditions in their native countries. But through the folk songs, it's possible, first of all, to remind them, and secondly, to instill in them a new pride in their regions, in their homelands, in their origins. And it does work. I can tell you it works. I'm a director of the Newport Folk Festival, and we get 60 to 70,000 people there every year for a weekend. And that betokens a great deal of interest and of enthusiasm.
In speaking a little while ago about folk rock music, you decried the substitution of form for content. This is something that you have also commented on in your writings on American Jewish youth of today. The fact, that is, that so many of them, in your opinion, substitute form for content. Could you elaborate on this?
Well, of course, yes. Pop songs, form was everything. The format was a thing. Now, with the new kind of music, the folk-based one, content becomes the all-important. Now, American Jewish youth, falling into the general trap of the alienated. Incidentally, I could go on about this also, because I've been lecturing about this at universities, falls into the trap of, by way of rejecting the form in which some facets of Jewish life have moved, I resent the notion that a Jewish kid has to go to Zen Buddhism to find out why he has to be a good human being before having looked in the attic of his own grandfather.
I guess it is your concern for applying Jewish precepts that has made you national vice president of the American Jewish Congress and founder of its arts chapter.
Well, you quite rightly put it in the right sequence. I am not concerned about Jewish matters because I'm an officer of the American Jewish Congress. I have become an officer of the American Jewish Congress because I'm concerned about American Jewry in particular and world Jewry in general, about the entire meaning of a continuum of experience. I want to know the relevance of Judaism in 1967, and I want to find its pace, I find its application. That's the most important thing. Application of Judaism to today, and that means to the space age, included. I want to know how I am to apply, and one can and should, my Judaism to 1967.
You are also active in the field of labor as first vice president of Actors Equity, representing all performers in the theater throughout American Canada. And you are active, I notice, in the reform wing of the Democratic Party.
Yes. Well, all these are interrelated and are linked to one another. For example, take the democratic process. I happen to believe that I can serve it best through being active in the Democratic Party, which, incidentally, I do not accept on face value. I am, as you said, in the reform wing of the Democratic Party. We have a saying, one of the sayings of our fathers, says, "Letaken olam," that is, to mend the world. You don't just accept things as you find them. You try to better them, to build on them. And so I try to reform the Democratic Party in the image in which it is meant to be. I maintain that as a Jew alone, there are other reasons, of course, why one wants this to flourish, but I don't believe I could blossom or bloom or flourish in a society where democracy and its safeguards are dead.
Mr. Bickel, if anyone's life can be said to be keyed to an intense pace, it is yours. You are truly a man running. Don't you ever get tired?
Sometimes I do. There's very little time, and there's a lot to... One has a lot to say. At least I feel I do. Perhaps it's presumptuous of me, but I would like to be able to say at least half of the things that I have to say before somebody puts an end to me.
I understand, Mr. Bickel, that you've recently taken to including a dramatic reading along with your folk singing, a parable by Bertolt Brecht.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's true. It's called The Parable of the Burning House. It's part of the things... You see, I'm an interpreter not only of music, but of the spoken word. And so this, too, has a bearing on our life and our times. It is largely about people who ask foolish questions while the heat is singeing their eyebrows in a burning house, instead of being hot enough to want to change for a better house.
Do you feel that your strong identification with things Jewish can or does interfere with your career as an actor?
I don't think so. It may, from time to time, impair one's employability, let us say, because there's some people who say, well, he's controversial, I don't know, he's so identified with causes and this and that. I have lost jobs, or at least jobs have not materialized because of it, I'm sure of it. But that is, believe me, a small price to pay, because I'm firmly convinced that I am where I am today, not in spite of what I am, not in spite of being a Jew, but perhaps because of it, and more than that, because I say so freely.
Could I ask about your future plans? Is there anything you can tell us about that?
I intend to continue exactly as I'm going, only more so, if time and energy and health will permit. And that'll mean more movies and more plays and more songs and more records. It will also mean more causes, and perhaps in my lifetime I'll be able to say we did a little bit to mend the world.
Our Eternal Light program today was the first of two conversations with outstanding public figures. Our guest was Theodore Bickel, folk singer, actor, and raconteur. He was interviewed by NBC News correspondent Elmer Peterson through the facilities of station KNBC, Hollywood, California. Interview material for today's program was written by Harold Flender. If you would like a copy of today's conversation program, please send your name and address, with 25 cents to cover the cost of postage and handling, to the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, 3080 Broadway, New York, New York, 10027. This is Vic Robey. The Eternal Light is directed by Kenneth MacGregor and presented weekly under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
This is the NBC Radio Network.